are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Thursday, December 7th, 2017. My name is Michael Brooks on a Michael Thursday pinch hitting for Sam Steeder, and this is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We're broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On today's program, Eric Levitt of New York Magazine, we're talking about the social consequences of the GOP's tax monstrosity, the potential coming GOP civil war over their plans for redistribution to the wealthy and a tax on the non-wealthy. Plus, who might replace Al Franken in the Senate if he does in fact resign? And of course, MSNBC. They have gotten a spinal transplant and rehired Sam Steeder. Shofar. That is a sign of mitzvah from our people, and also very upsetting to the types of characters that would try to get Sam off of MSNBC. But don't worry, the Thernovich documentary project continues. Thank you, Mike, for priming the interest.
With renewed vigor
and helping get together the seed funding for exposing you. Donald Trump has unleashed a new crisis in the Middle East by recognizing Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. There is protests, rage in the Palestinian occupied territories, and many right-wing pundits are using this as a good time to trot out one of the last acceptable forms of just kind of rank stupid bigotry in America, which is, of course, those aimed at Arabs. We will talk about that and worldwide reaction to it, plus new figures on wealth concentration in America. Not good. Time magazine names the Me Too movement as its person of the year. Mike Flynn, not looking great for that dude. But maybe some of the policies that he was offering Russia weren't necessarily bad, but how he was doing it, it's a major problem. Plus, the Pentagon confirms that there are approximately 2,000 U.S. troops on the ground in Syria. Just a little side project. And the corporate tax cut in the tax bill could affect the GOP hunt for votes. We'll get back to that with Eric. All that and more on today's Majority Report. If you're new to the program, we're going to do a little round robin here. My name is Michael Brooks. I'm a co-host on the show. I usually host the show about once a week. You will hear me, occasionally see me in a split screen the rest of the days of the week, co-hosting, co-anchoring it with Sam, doing impressions, politics, hopefully adding to the commentary, and then we'll just go around. To the left, we have Matt Leck.
Hello.
Producer extraordinaire, Jamie Peck.
Hey.
She is a contributor, on-air presence and personality, as everybody is here, in fact, and producer as well. She's also a writer. You can check her writing out in many places, including The Guardian and Paste and elsewhere. And then we have the great Brendan Finn, researcher, producer, writer.
Sorry, my name doesn't rhyme with Peck and Leck.
Peck Leck, the Peck Leck duo. So just to let everybody know who we are, let's get to a very fun piece of sound that occurred on Fox News. Was this from last night? So what's been amazing about the kind of rise of Trump and the alt-right and all of these narratives about things like the deep state and all of a sudden this deep concern from people with very hard far-right extremist politics with things like FBI abuses and the military-industrial complex. It's been fascinating to watch them collect the terms and concern about those issue areas and then apply it to their own bizarre conspiracy matrix in an effort to defend a incredibly out of control just insane White House. And there was a real standout moment of that with a guy named Greg Jarrett, who was sort of like the C-team Sean Hannity, except he's sitting across from Sean Hannity. This is the amazing thing about Fox, is they have so much resources that they hire, like, they're like, let's just get the D-list version of our main anchors too, just throw them on air. So this is like almost Sean and Greg looking at reflections of each other. I didn't really know Greg. I hadn't really heard from Greg Jarrett before, but here he is going deep on the FBI. And I have some curiosity about, after this rant, what future journalism we can expect from Greg Jarrett.
I think we now know that the Mueller investigation is illegitimate and corrupt. And Mueller has been using the FBI as a political weapon. And the FBI has become America's secret police. Secret surveillance, wiretapping, intimidation, harassment, and threats. It's like the old KGB that comes for you in the dark of the night, banging through your door.
This is not a game. This is not hyperbole you're using here.
No, ask Paul Manafort. Mm. They came for him and broke through his front door.
And if it can happen to him, Greg,
it can happen to all of us. Absolutely. The FBI is a shadow government now. It has become highly politicized. Peter Strzok.
I'm really looking forward to Greg Hampton's future reporting on Greg Jarrett's future reporting on Fred Hampton and COINTELPRO and the FBI's war on civil rights leaders, its behavior around Leonard Peltier and Native American activists, its infiltration of environmental groups, its abuse of the civil liberties and human rights of pretty much any actual left movement that you can imagine in the entirety of modern American history since the thing was formed by J. Edgar Hoover, who is really one of the most demented and dangerous figures in all of American life. I would actually say that when the FBI is poking around a plutocrat, global, mega lobbyist, scumbag political consultant with ties not only to oligarchs, but past campaign work for everybody from Donald Trump to every type of crooked corporation you could imagine in the 80s, to the Pakistani intelligence services, to Joseph Zavimbi and the UNITA rebels while they were burying people alive in Angola. That's Paul Manafort's record. I think if the FBI wants to kick in his front door, I'm down. But if we want to talk about a history of abuses of the FBI targeting all sorts of people that Fox News demonizes on a regular basis, I'd be up for it. Balls in your court, buddy. Greg Jarrett, truth crusader against the abusive overreaches of the FBI. We're in a new world.
Most interesting thing about Greg Jarrett that I've found so far, Matt, this might be of interest to you, being from the upper Midwest, is that he was arrested for intoxication at the airport there. And
in Bismarck?
In the Midwest?
Wait, like, which airport? There's more than one airport in the Midwest.
Minneapolis.
Oh, okay.
I love that. That was so tri-state of Brendan. He was just like, he was arrested at the Midwest airport.
You know that one there.
You know the one that's out there. You know, the bullshit part of the country. You know what I'm saying?
That was that New Yorker cover. Right
there. Yeah, exactly. We are playing our exact roles here on the show. I'm glad Greg Jarrett's back on his feet and that wasn't a career ender. Of course, we all wish him a speedy and apparently he's doing really well. He looks like he's great. He was out there swinging, really upset about Paul Manafort. That would be an amazing character if Jarrett legitimately got into it. And just to let everybody know, Sam will be back tomorrow. He obviously needs to take a little bit of a rest. There's all sorts of places.
That was overdue.
That was very overdue. He was getting very, very enervated. I was thinking about, like, and I hope that Mike Thernovich is watching. And one of the things that's been most gratifying to this, because also Sebastian Gorka, who was that sort of just ludicrous Vichy Wren, living the American dream, you know, pseudo terrorism expert, hyperpower moron. Who,
it's Vitezi Rend, get it right.
Oh, excuse me, Vitezi Rend. That was the group with some really interesting perspectives on who should have won World War II that he was affiliated with.
Who he wore the pin to the inauguration.
Yeah, well, you got a rep. You know, fascism recognized fascism. Clown fascism recognized clown fascism. But he tweeted this out about Sam when Cernovich was drumming up this nonsense. And I think part of the lesson that we take from it is that these idiots have been actually watching us do our routines.
We're in your head.
And that is very gratifying. I really hope that Gorka, specifically, I hope everybody could, if you'll really indulge me here, I did a video where we reviewed part of Dr. Gorka's thesis, quote unquote, where he got his PhD. From what was this school? It was like the Donald Trump Institute for International and Strategic Affairs or something.
It's like the online university of Bucharest.
It was like the online university, something like that. And he had the most. He had a graph that was so stupid that I actually, in a moment of deep humility, was like, "Am I too dumb to get this?"
Yes.
So I hope they're all tuning in. And Mike, don't worry. Forward and onward with the documentary as well. I mean, obviously, first and foremost, this has been with Sam. But, you know, this is a community here and we all work on this and we've all kind of gone through this together. So nothing but appreciation for everybody. I mean, from this incredible community of supporters we have. I was talking about the other night on my show. About really how, you know, ultimately part of the reason that even if things had not worked out this well, and even if MSNBC had not done the right thing and things kind of, you know, there was some measure of actual reality restored to the situation, we could still go after these people and be honest and be aggressive and have unapologetic, serious left politics because we're supported by you, you know, financially and otherwise. And people came out, and then, of course, you know, I mean, tons of, I mean, just too numerous to mention of people that were, you know, I know friends of Sam and just lots of kind of high profile and community people. It's incredibly honoring and gratifying, and we're just going to redouble our efforts and keep exposing. For people new to Cernovich, that is an impression of him, which I will be... You thought I did these impressions often before. Okay, everybody.
Oh, by the way, just one more note. If we do a Gorka video and you enjoy it on YouTube, just put that in as replies.
Yes, please. All replies of this content, you can just bombard it with all of these morons. You know, there's a synchronized thing where obviously this country under Republican leadership and this country under corporate and plutocratic dominance, we have to be very, very serious about reversing mass oppression and inequality of every shape and form, both nationally and internationally. And that's a goal of this show. And we're actually quite sort of, you know, we're sincere about it. And these people, the Cernoviches, the Gorkas, the Trumps, the Trump Juniors, the whoever, they... Every day, we need to make them objects of disdain, ridicule, and buffoonery because the threat they pose is serious, but nothing else about them is. And we are going to continue. We will be right back on the Majority Report with Eric Levitz.
Time after time, I've done my sentence, but committed no crime. And bad mistakes, I've made a few, I've had my share.
fame and fortune and everything that goes with it. I thank you all, but it's been no bed of roses.
We're having fun here. Welcome back to the Majority Report. I'm Michael Brooks. Joining us now is Eric Levitz. He's a staff writer for New York Magazine. Eric, thanks so much for joining us. How are you doing?
I'm doing just fine. How are you?
Today is very fun. I'm not going to lie to you.
Yeah, it seems like you guys kind of got a best all world situation out of this.
Yeah, I mean, the thing it reminded me of is when, and my dad actually had me stop doing this appropriately, but when I was like 6, 7 years old and he would take me out to play tennis before it got, you know, a little bit more serious, it would, what I would do, I could play, right? I had some ability to play and I would watch like the Grand Slams and everything. And so what I would do is I would basically like script out the match. Right, like we do, like a couple minutes. We're like, all right, like it's 15:40. You're ahead of me. It's the final of the French Open. You had 2 match points now I'm gonna come back and I'm gonna win every single point for like the rest of the set or something. And he'd be like, all right, sure, fine, you know. And then he would like, you know, pretend that I was, you know, hitting all these winners, and he would be in the net and pretend to throw his racket and all this stuff. And I was like, I've not seen anything in my life that has actually as closely reflected the rigged tennis matches of a 6-year-old me as what just happened over the last 6 days. It was just like free press, check. Exposure of a alt-right troll in a total Andres Escobar own goal fashion, check. And then ultimately, of course, you know, finally some actual spine and sanity on the part of MSNBC. But I mean, this has bigger implications for all of us. I'm not just journalists, but really, in fact, I mean, the institution of a press, if this was going to be the game, continue to be the game, I should say.
Yeah, I mean, I think Cernovich was very open about the fact that he was pleased that this formula had paid off so well and that he planned to replicate it over and over with any prominent liberal commentators that happened to have tweets that could be misinterpreted. If you really decide that you just don't understand the concept of irony.
Right.
And I think also it's just good to see MSNBC's core viewership actually like exerting a little bit of influence over that network.
Definitely.
Which has, since Andy Lack took the reins and even after Trump won, despite the fact that there's this clear, large and intense audience for, progressive political content, has really decided that the Santa is White lady should be a marquee presence at the network, and brought on Hugh Hewitt and all these other right. whatever. So, yeah, it's just good to see that there is a limit to how much they can move the goalposts right at that network.
Absolutely. And also a limit to on them, you know, sort of getting back and, I guess, you know, just kind of having a basic assessment of the, you know, situation. And, you know, obviously, like, you know, credit to them for, you know, doing the right thing here finally. Let's talk briefly. I mean, I don't know if it's confirmed yet. As of the show, it might be, but Al Franken is expected to resign. I'm not really interested in going. He's done. Yeah. So I guess he's resigned. I'm not really interested in going and sort of relitigating all of it. I think, you know, the next thing is really honestly just the politics of who replaces him, how it's done. I have a Keith Ellison bias, but I know there's a lot of other names in the mix, obviously. You have some reporting on this. Who do you think is going to be replacing Al Franken and why?
Yeah, so this is all pretty preliminary, and I think it's mainly, I believe everybody's going off this scoop from Politico. So nothing set in stone, but the picture that's emerging right now is that the female lieutenant governor of Minnesota, Tina Smith, is the favorite. And the idea here is that she has already signaled, she already passed up running for to replace the Democratic governor of Minnesota, Mark Dayton, earlier this year. And she basically signaled that she's not really long for politics. She kind of wants to finish up her run and go back to private life. And this makes her an ideal candidate for Dayton because, at least in this reporting, he isn't comfortable. There's like a lot of strong candidates on the bench for Democrats in Minnesota. The party's really divided, especially after the Bernie-Hillary race. And he doesn't want to put his thumb on the scales and pick one side of the party versus the other. And so his thinking is, I'll appoint somebody who will not run for... So basically, he appoints somebody for a year in November 2018. They have to actually try to get elected to the seat.
Mm-hmm.
If he was picking somebody who was really interested in retaining it, they would have the power of incumbency.
Mm-hmm.
That would essentially make them shoe in for the Democratic nomination and give them a better chance of beating the Republican. But Dayton, in order to avoid intra-party conflict, he's appointing someone who he thinks will just bow out, and then there can be an open Democratic primary where Democratic voters will be able to decide who they want to be Franken's replacement.
But what are her politics like? I mean, the thing, you know, Franken, I mean, if I'm blunt, I mean, I certainly have much more left politics than Franken, but he was... first, obviously, you're losing somebody who did have an ability to humiliate Republicans and was effective in framing certain issues. And that's important. And in some sense, I think having somebody like an Ellison who could kind of come and do that out of the gate himself, there's a lot of value that probably would, you know, supersede the sort of concerns that Dayton has. But that's understandable. But setting that aside, I mean, what are her politics like? I mean, is she going to be at least in the sort of, you know, kind of genuine sort of center left liberal mode as Franken? Is she maybe actually progressive, or is she more to the kind of Clinton wing?
Yeah, I am not a guru of Gopher State politics, and I'm not familiar with Smith's background. I know that she played a role in helping to rebuild the bridge there that collapsed in 2007, and that she's been a key ally to Dayton, the governor, since 2010. But
and he's pretty liberal. He's a fairly liberal governor. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think ultimately, if you take her at her word or take Politico at their word, if she's only going to be in there for a year, it's not going to matter very much. Joe Manchin has pretty much voted with Bernie Sanders on every legislative issue that's really come up this year. So, I mean, it's ultimately, it's a defensive mode where pretty much any replacement level Democrat is going to serve the function for the next year.
Right. And also there's obviously, you know, significance and value to having a woman taking that seat in light of everything happening as well.
Exactly.
So let's get now to, first of all, just more generally, you actually see some, and correct me if I'm wrong, but you think there might actually still be some hiccups in finalizing this tax bill as the Republicans go into conference. Now, you know, and we should be clear, and you can elaborate on this, that again, even just sort of calling it a tax bill in some ways kind of minimizes. I mean, this really is a very, this would structurally set in place the kind of next wave of deepening inequality and even affect austerity at a state level. So this is a, you know, major goal for Republican legislators and the people who fund them, but you still think they're going to potentially run into trouble here. I mean, if that's so, what's the dynamic behind that?
Yeah, I mean, I think almost certainly they're going to get this thing through. The fact that they've been willing to do so far to get these tax cuts to the point where they've gotten suggests that they're willing to do anything.
Right.
That said, the problem that they have is that they their ruthlessness came back to bite them on the Senate bill because they were obsessed with trying to pass it last Friday, even though they had to massively rewrite it for a variety of reasons, and everyone saw the scribbles in the margins, they basically what happened was they were initially planning to get rid of the corporate alternative minimum tax.
Mm-hmm.
So right now you've got the statutory top corporate rate that's 35%, and then you have all these deductions and tax credits. And basically the alternative minimum tax says, all right, no matter how many deductions you rack up, you can't go below 20%. You got to pay 20% of your profits, except, of course, for the profits that you stash overseas and that you don't pay anything on,
right,
which is a whole other part of this. Anyhow, so they take the alternative minimum tax out. They lower the top corporate rate to 20%. And then on Friday, McConnell promises Colin that he'll put in this $10,000 property deduction. because they're getting rid of otherwise the SALT deduction, the state and local income tax deduction in high-income states. Collins wants to, you know, preserve that upper-middle-class benefit. So he puts that back in. Ron Johnson is getting an extremely big tax break for the kind of business that his family owns. He owns a pass-through business, mm-hmm. Which is totally unjustifiably getting a giant tax cut, even though no economic theory says that giving a tax break to pass-through businesses is a good idea. But right. He wants an even bigger tax break.
Wait, what's his business? His family has a real... They don't own like some little boutique, right? I mean, it's a pretty large-scale business that he's involved in, right?
You know, I gotta look it up. Yeah. I thought it was... Is it car dealership?
I think it's something like anyhow. That. Yeah, anyways. Okay, yeah. That's extraordinary.
Yeah, okay. So he wants an even bigger present, right. And he was able to, like... you know, you've got to actually respect Ron John, who's widely regarded as a very dumb man.
Yes.
When he saw Corker and Flake holding up the bill because of deficit concerns, he latched on as the third, but he wasn't actually concerned about the deficit. He just wanted a larger tax break for his family and was able to get that.
And in that sense, he is truly the quintessential Republican. Like, you know, it's so embarrassing that the press even can still give a second to these people grandstanding about the deficit. But when a guy says, I will hold this up to literally personally net my family more income, that's who you should be listening to. That is the core of the Republican Party right there.
Oh, absolutely. So McConnell makes these concessions, and suddenly the tax bill gets way more expensive. They have this $1.5 trillion cap on how much it can cost because of the budget resolution they passed, complicated Senate rules. And so they need new revenue stat. On Friday night, if they're going to pass this by the end of the week, like McConnell has decided he has to for no particular reason. And so they decided, you know, we'll put the corporate alternative minimum tax back into the bill. But they forgot to lower the corporate alternative minimum income tax. So now they have a statutory rate of 20%, the regular rate, and then you can collect as many deductions as you want, but you can't go below 20%. So they set the two rates at the exact same level, which means that, like, almost all corporate deductions suddenly are now worthless.
Mm.
It's a like $300 billion difference. They basically took $300 billion worth of tax cuts away from their corporate donors, and their corporate donors are pissed.
Right. So what are they going to do? This is the whole point of the tax cut, is give away to people like their corporate donors.
Right, and certain kinds of businesses, this will really like nullify the benefit of the tax cut almost entirely. So that puts them in a position now where they have this bill that they actually initially they were thinking, you know, maybe we'll go to conference with the House, you know, we'll reconcile the bill that the House passed and the bill that the Senate passed. But also we have like a 3 in the Senate. You know, we don't want to test that again. So if there's any trouble in conference, we'll just have the House pass what the Senate passed. Mm-hmm. Now, that's a very, very undesirable option. A lot of their corporate donors will flip out if they pass the Senate version through the House and make that the law, which means they got to go back to the Senate. I don't know if they actually had a crisis and had to choose between no tax cuts and doing the tax cut that eliminates corporate deductions, which ironically is actually like what tax reform traditionally is lower the rates and get rid of deductions.
Right.
But the donors don't want that. I think they probably pass it anyway, but who knows? They've got a really undesirable situation here. And the other factor is that, it passed by 2 votes in the Senate. And Susan Collins said that she was only voting for it, only voting to repeal the individual mandate in Obamacare, which found its way into the tax bill,
mm-hmm.
because McConnell promised her that as soon as she votes for this tax cut, Republicans will pass new funding shoring up Obamacare. They'll pass, they'll replace the subsidies that Trump canceled, and they'll establish this reinsurance program to lower premiums. And she said, "So I'm not really like betraying you guys on health care because I got these promises that
yeah, she should
the damage
totally
I'm about to vote
take
for.
That to the bank for sure."
Yeah, and. House conservatives, Paul Ryan, are not willing to give Collins cover for another couple weeks. They're already saying, no, we're not going to do that. Or at least we're not promising to do that. We never promised to do that. McConnell can't tell you what we're going to do. And so Collins doesn't have a fig leaf anymore. Now she needs to vote to sabotage Obamacare without pretending that she knows that she's going to be able to fix it afterwards.
Right.
So, and there are people occupying Susan Collins' office today. She's under a lot of pressure. This tax bill is not getting more popular.
Right.
It's the least popular piece of tax legislation in modern American history, which is astounding because that means it's a tax cut that is less popular than any tax hike that's been passed in the last four decades, unprecedented.
Yeah. And people, I think it's so naked. I mean, it's like if you get to the analogy I always use is that, you know, John McCain voted to give his trust fund baby daughter a gift of a untaxed estate. And if you're making 40 grand a year or 30 grand a year, you have to work harder and probably end up paying a bit more to subsidize that gift. I mean, that's really the bottom. There's a lot more, not to mention even the things that, like, I know that the deduction for graduate students got taken out of the Senate version. I mean, but there has been, and the attack on Obamacare, which we already kind of went through. I mean, it's hard to hide the ball on what this is. And then when you even have like a meeting with Gary Cohn and a bunch of executives not even raising their hands to pretend that they're going to use this to reinvest in jobs, I mean, you know, it becomes kind of hard.
And Republican lawmakers saying out loud, asked by the press, why are you pushing forward this, and saying, like, as their official line, the donors are going to, like, I think Lindsey Graham and Congressman Chris Collins said, like, the financial contributions are going to dry up if we don't do this. The bill is an expression of the Republican Party's confidence that American democracy is no longer functional.
Right.
That is the bet that they are proudly making right now, is that we have, you know, that sucker isn't getting up. We knocked the crap out of it, and it is not going to be able to stand back up.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah.
So, and I don't know. We'll see. I mean, right now, the problem is, for Republicans, I'm really astounded by how much the public actually gets what this bill is about, given the disconnect generally between, you know, what the Republican Party stands for and what the polls show the public thinking it stands for. Generally speaking, people did not catch on to just how plutocratic Trump would be previously. But I think it is that, you know, there's a stereotype about Republicans, which is that they care about the rich more than anyone else. And generally, parties make an effort not to completely confirm the stereotype that the public has about them. So this is often unfortunate on the Democratic side because they kind of are really worried about being seen as the party that's soft on crime, or, you know, dovish on war, or like for minorities. And so, like, they generally want bipartisan cover to, like, sort of do liberal things on those issues, like criminal justice reform or whatever.
Right, like actual things that we urgently need to do. But on the other, I mean, comedically, the contrast would be if there was a Democratic convention in, like, you know, 2012, and Obama, I'll just pick as a random year, it was like, you know, Obama was like, all right, we're going to have a group, we're going to pray to Mecca, then we're going to have a giant love-in with some people from the Stop War Coalition, and then we're going to deconstruct masculine identity, third night of the DNC. This is essentially what the Republicans are doing. They're like, yes.
And then they asked about it, and Bernie Sanders was like, you know, we got to do this or else the Nation of Islam will cut off their contributions.
If we don't do this, then the Black Panther shock troops won't stop white people from voting, and then we're doomed. This is literally what the Republicans are doing right now. And so you also, another important, and just I want to add throughout all this, I think it's incredibly bleak. I think that there's no doubt that this is all about calls that they're getting from their donors, and the donors are angry. And by the way, you know, let's be real. There isn't a real internal conflict in the Republican Party. If these people fail the whole Bannon, quote unquote, insurgency, then the plutocrats can just flip their money to those candidates, and we'll have another wave of another group of extremists that in primary people and get, you know, they win primaries fueled off of the xenophobia and, you know, whatever the conspiracy de jure is. And then they'll be in Congress with an even, you know, sort of next level commitment to undermine democracy and redistribute wealth to the top. So there's no doubt what the Republican incentive structure is, but there still is definitely room here, as bleak as it is, to, you know, light up phones and put a lot of pressure on these people. Because I do think even for them, they're not used to how immensely unpopular this is. You could tell in the beginning of the process that they still did think, oh, you know, this is, now we're back in our comfort zone. Now we do our tax reform spiel and everybody likes that, right? And it's, you know, clearly reversing their faces. I just want to touch on another thing related to this tax cut, though. You have another piece that you put up recently called After Tax Cuts for the Rich, Trump Hopes to Take Food Away from Poor Kids. And that's, of course, the plan. I mean, the plan is that these tax giveaways will blow up the deficit. They won't do anything to create jobs and steam the economy. We know that. And then what happens is after they do the, just like with Bush, they blow up the deficit. There aren't the results that are promised. Inequality's high, all the rest. And then we go back to, oh my God, spending's out of control. We need to attack Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. It's a very synchronized, holistic effort that they have in terms of these plans of wealth redistribution to the top. But I think there's something so just kind of primitive and basic and cruel about all of these plans. But, you know, Medicare and Social Security are in incredible danger, always with Republicans and neoliberal Democrats. But they also affect a lot of people, and there is some muscle behind them. Poor kids don't have lobbyists scrolling legislation for Mitch McConnell. And if you really wanted to distill how fundamentally grotesque this is, I mean, this is a tax cut for lobbyists and people on television that will directly translate to literally taking food out of children's mouths. It doesn't get more grotesque than that.
Yeah, I mean, my argument is that I understand the concern from liberals about they're going to blow up the deficit and then, you know, push these cuts. But I think that, like, if you look, like, we have, like, a pretty large, like, if you just look at the absolute number, you have a scary number deficit already. Mm-hmm. Adding $1.5 trillion to that over a decade, I don't think makes that big a difference. Like, I think that...
Not in reality, I don't think the public, but they'll use it.
I don't think the public cares about the deficit, really. I don't think there's any scenario where what the Republicans want to do is popular. So I think that ultimately... Right. If they're going to push through these like welfare reforms, it's going to be because it's just what they want to do, and not because there's any like political like logic to doing so, or because like I think that they would do it even if they didn't pass the tax cut if they actually have the will to do it.
Right.
But I think my argument with the attack on the poor is that less than making up for the debt that they're racking up like fiscally with the tax bill is like making up for this like populist kind of debt, like they kind of just portrayed like they're like populist working class, middle class base, in a really flagrant and obvious way, like we were just saying. And now it offers welfare reform, shifting the conversation to the parasitic poor, so-called or whatever, offers them quote an opportunity unquote. To like remind their base that like, hey, remember which class you hate. You hate that social class below you that's like taking your like, is sucking off the government teat. You're not mad at the social class above you that is sucking off their, parents inherited income and capital gains. And like, you hate the idle poor, not the idle rich, remember?
Right. No, I think that goes back to the 80s research on Reagan Democrats. And one of the things that always struck me that they found was that some of these people would basically say, look, we know that Republicans are going to screw us and they're going to favor corporations and they're going to harm our livelihoods. But, and they didn't say it this bluntly maybe, but they were basically like, but we're also really racist. And we know that Democrats are not truly populist or left enough to protect us from corporations, but they might do some stuff for poor people of color who we really hate. So at least with the Republicans, they'll punch down on those people. It's the same dynamic.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, Trump gave a rally last week in Missouri where he said, does anyone want welfare reform? And he said, I know people that work three jobs and they live next to somebody who doesn't work at all. The person who is not working at all and has no intention of working at all is making more money and doing better than the person that's working his or her ass off. So he's really trying to cultivate this class resentment that's downward looking. And I think the real tell is this is about stigmatizing the poor and like stirring up hatred for the poor as opposed to actually saving money. I mean, first of all, is that our country doesn't spend enough money on poor people to like actually get deficit savings there, like because we just don't spend that much money on them.
Right, of course.
But the second one is that like they're trying to facilitate Scott Walker's plan to drug test food stamp recipients, and we've already many states have tried this already, and actually costs more money to administer these tests that humiliate food stamp recipients than you save by like denying food to the children of women who have smoked marijuana in the last month.
Right.
I mean, it's unconscionable morally and as a policy, but also it makes no sense even if your concern is just saving money. It's about stigmatizing the poor.
Right. It's an attack. But I do think, though, that I think big picture and what really drives it in terms of the politics of the base, you're absolutely right. But I do think that we can never forget, and this just goes back to, I guess, my kind of formative political experiences of, you know, the 2010, 2011, of, you know, Obama's willingness to move far to the right in terms of cuts on Medicare and Social Security. The we're in this massive Wall Street-fueled economic crisis, but somehow we're talking about austerity, which is the exact opposite of what will renew the economy. And the reason I point this out is I do think, and the dynamics of the Democratic Party are very different. So you will see it's going to be very different, you know, like it was several years ago. Democratic leaders could come out and call for austerity and cuts. Now it's much more tricky for them to do so. But you will absolutely see, you know, the kind of quote-unquote centrist, quote-unquote responsible people world, which is totally discredited, they're going to come out and they're going to do the, you know, high-minded deficit nonsense version of why we need to do these cruel counterproductive policies and structural attacks on Medicare and Social Security. That is going to come, and that's going to be, you know, the part of the attack that tries to appeal to, you know, an incredibly small demographic of quote-unquote middle voters, but one that is, you know, pretty affluent and has totally disproportionate influence in conversation.
Yeah, I mean, I think that two things. One, I think that the Republican dream is making a Democratic president sign cuts to Social Security and Medicare. That's what they want. They want the bipartisan cover, and they want people to actually think that the Democrats were the driving force behind it. That's what they desperately wanted during the Obama presidency and almost got. If they do it with United Republican government, it's like just a suicide mission. And I don't know that it makes that much sense from them, because if it is a suicide mission, or again, like I said before, they think they've broken American democracy, they can do whatever the hell they want.
Mm-hmm.
But on the other point, yeah, I think that there was a sincere belief within the Obama administration that the public really was motivated by the deficit, that the Tea Party was really, like, at least partially about the debt and not just about the fact that we had a black president.
Right.
And just like a white, you know, racial resentment tantrum. And I think there's a lot more beyond the fact that the party has moved left and is since then just generally, I think there is also a consciousness of, oh wait, like no one really cares about the debt. Like if we actually had a situation where we had high inflation and high interest rates and there was like an obvious debt crisis that was making people's material lives harder, then yeah, they'd care about the debt. Otherwise, like, it's just a big number that, like, you just can ignore.
Otherwise, debt just meant black president or out-of-control spending or Chicago politics meant Muslim or whatever, you know, like all of that kind of nonsense. I mean, before we wrap this up, I mean, do you think that there is, I mean, maybe I'm stating the obvious here, but there is utility in continuing to put as much pressure, you know, particularly on a Collins on this type of thing. Everybody should be reminded that, you know, Murkowski, who voted the right way on healthcare, she essentially traded her vote on this for drilling in the Arctic wildlife refuge, which is one of the most just sort of, you know, I mean, just the kind of disgusting deal. People should remember exactly who she is and who all of these people are. And then, you know, more broadly, I mean, you know, they started the class war, and we're going to have to finish it.
Yeah, I mean, I think Collins is in a more difficult position than she was in the first vote, and I think that you've got a lot of Republican senators who are very near death, you know, where, like, there's just an actuarial risk, like, every week with Thad Cochran and John McCain, and then obviously there's the Doug Jones Alabama race, which is, you know, so they really did not want to have to go back to the Senate. And they're going to have to go back there, and they can only lose two votes. So, I think there's definitely reason to be mobilizing around that and to see if you can make their lives harder.
Absolutely. Yeah. Make their lives as hard as possible on the phones and on email and in nonviolent demonstrations. It is the least you can do to repay them for all their plans that they have to shorten people's lives and increase mass human suffering so that I guess like the Koch brothers can look at another data point in some bank vertical or something, whatever the justification is. Eric Levitz, he's a staff writer for New York Magazine. I really appreciate your time, man.
Yes, thanks for having me.
Thank you. All right, everybody. We are going to go in a few minutes to the fun half. This is where we take your IMs, we take your calls, and it's also something that only members get. So join the Majority Report, majority.fm, / become a member. $10 a month, you get a 5-day-a-week show with all premium content. And, you know, I guess the fun half is there's a lot more entertainment value in it. This is, we give you the deep nutrition up front and then a lot of comedy in the second half, including characters like my Nation of Islam Obama, who did briefly make an appearance there.
Who's laughing now, Sam?
That's a good one. Oh, God. I think that Mike Cernovich added like a 10-year life expectancy to Sam's, like, life. To life and to like his verticality.
Mike Cernovich.com.
Can you hit me with the other one again, please? One more time.
Who's laughing now, Sam?
We are. Thank you. And very eager.
Basically all week.
Yes, we've been laughing and very eager to get to work on the documentary. I host the Michael Brooks Show, which launched in August. That is a show that comes out for public once a week, for patrons 3 times a week. It's a deep dive show, also from the left, the Democratic Socialist left, with illicit histories, premium content. We're at about 850 something patrons. Our first goal is to reach 1K. You can check it out, patreon.com/TMBS, or subscribe to it on iTunes, Michael Brooks Show. There's a bunch of reviews on it there. It's also on YouTube on the Sam Cedar Majority Report channel, which you guys should all subscribe to as well. 646-257-3920, 646-257-3920. We will see you in the fun half.
RM for it.
All right, folks, 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half.
Are you ready?
Who sent us this?
Anarchy. Alpha males are back. Back, 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 back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back. Back.
Just as delicious as you can imagine.
The alpha males are back, 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 boy, back. And the alpha males are back, 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 back.
Just wanna degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back, back.
I take all of it in my throat.
Alpha males are back, 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 back.
Almost as what?
The alpha males are back, 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 back.
You are a madman.
And the alpha males are back.
I am a total cunt.
Can we bring back DJ Danerke's song, please?
Yeah, or a couple of them. Just put them in rotation.
DJ Danerke.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough of a break for people.
That's fucking nonsense.
Hey, folks, fucking reminder.
I do not have Parkinson's.
And the alpha males are...
Psych. Fuck them. Fuck them.
Almost says what?
What?
Almost says what?
Have you tried doing an impression on a college campus?
I think that there's no reason why reasonable people across the divide can't all agree with this. Psych.
And the alpha males are back, 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 back. And the Africans are black, 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 black African. And the alpha males are back, 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 back. And the Africans are black, black, black.
there, doesn't a little part of you think that America deserves to be taken over by jihadists? Keeping it 100.
Can't knock the hustle. Come on! Fuck them. Fuck them. Fuck them. Things I do for the bigger game plan.
By the way, it's my birthday!
My birthday!
Happy birthday to me, Jew boy!
I have a thought experiment for you.
And the alpha males are back, back. Africans are black, black. Alpha males are back, back. Africans are black, black.
Come on! To pay the price for blasphemy around here.
I am a total
pussy. Total, pussy, 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 total, pussy.